you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
LAist Studios.
Today on the LA Report, LA County speeds up hiring for a new court program that can mandate mental health care. The LA Pride Festival is held in LA State Historic Park today.
What made those movements legendary is ensuring that there is a space for folks.
And a 40-year legal battle ends in a new beachside path. Also coming up a little bit later, I talk with lead reporter Caitlin Hernandez about their new LAist series exploring stories of queer joy in LA. Then what was it like being a K-pop superstar in the early days of the industry? We're going to find out in an episode of LAist Studios podcast, K-Pop Dreaming. It's Saturday, June 10th. I'm Julia Paskin, and that's all coming up on the weekend edition of the LA Report from LAist 89.3. LA County has approved accelerated hiring for its care courts. That's the new state-mandated program with the power to direct people living with serious mental illnesses to a court-ordered care plan. The county's Department of Mental Health needs to fill 110 positions from office work to clinicians to IT. Connie Draxler is the department's chief deputy director.
We have a job for you, no matter what your background is. You can come in entry level and maybe do an administrative job that supports our clinicians. Maybe you want to be a community health worker. Maybe you are graduating from college or about to graduate next year and you want to come into being a mental health professional.
The care court system is due to launch in December. In other news, today LA Pride takes over LA State Historic Park with headliners including Mariah Carey. Gerald Garth is board president of Christopher Street West, which has run LA Pride since 1970.
We know Pride began as a protest. A great deal of what made those movements legendary is ensuring that there is a space for folks to show up authentically, but also safely.
The organization celebrates its 53rd anniversary with this year's theme, All Out with Pride. Tomorrow's main event will be the Free LA Pride Parade, kicking off at 11 a.m. on Sunset and Highland. The parade ends on Hollywood Boulevard, where Pride Village will feature local food, artists, and entertainment until 8 at night. After a 40-year dispute with landowners, the California Coastal Commission has approved a new path from Pacific Coast Highway down to Escondido Beach in Malibu. The small stretch of sand sits between Jeffrey's Restaurant and Paradise Cove. Lisa Hagee, chief of enforcement with the commission, says the original owners
were required to allow an easement to be opened up from PCH to the ocean and also to put in a parking easement on the edge of PCH. Through a variety of mishaps, that never happened.
Enforcement officers say the decades-long battle was won in part due to powers the California legislature granted the commission in 2014 to levy fines to violators. The new trail with updated parking amenities is expected to open by 2025. And in other news, the Los Angeles City Council voted this week to make Juneteenth, the day that marks the end of slavery, an official city holiday for non-represented city employees and employees represented by other labor organizations. On June 19, 1865, enslaved Black Americans were told they were free. Last year, Council made Juneteenth a paid holiday for city employees, but that only applied for employees represented by the Coalition of City Unions. In 2021, President Joe Biden signed legislation that made Juneteenth a federal holiday. LAist has launched a new ongoing reporting project focusing on queer stories, all told through the lens of joy. It's called Queer LA, and I spoke with lead reporter Caitlin Hernandez about the stories they plan to cover and why.
So I woke up this morning and started to go to Twitter, which is like a horrible toxic thing that I do working in the news industry like every morning. And I found myself kind of in like a doom scrolling hole, reading some of the discourse about the backlash against Pride in schools. There's been a couple of incidents in Glendale and in North Hollywood that you've actually reported on. And I was like, man, I'm feeling really bad. I'm a queer person. And I was having some difficulty processing it. And then I was like, oh, maybe this is why Caitlin is doing their project, Queer LA. Like, this feels like an antidote to what I'm feeling right now. So with that, can you tell everybody else about your reporting project, Queer LA, and specifically the focus of the stories that you're reporting on?
Yes, definitely. You know, I'm glad that you bring that up because I think what you're describing is exactly the goal I have for it. So Queer LA is a new series at LAist that we're doing that is for LGBTQ plus stories. But, you know, as you mentioned, the news cycle is really, really rough right now. If you're in the community and also if you're just watching, you know, from abroad, it can be tough to see these attacks on our rights. So I wanted to create a space where our stories could be uplifted and positive and focus on joy. So that's the focus of Queer LA. I want to center the people behind this community and explore how we live more fully and tell our stories. And like I said, focus on joy to really bring that more fully into the zeitgeist of what's going on in this conversation.
And can you talk about the use of the word queer? Like, it's a word that I'm personally very comfortable with, but not everybody is. Talk about why you went with that term.
Yes, yes. You know, and I should note too, I use the word myself too to describe, you know, my own identity. I'm queer and non-binary. But, you know, when we did launch the project, we did hear from some folks who weren't comfortable with us using the term. And I hear that and I respect that. I think this is a situation where people being comfortable with the term or uncomfortable, both of those viewpoints are very valid. And that stems from queer's history as a slur for that term. Because, you know, back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, it was used pejoratively against primarily effeminate gay men and people who would be in drag or who were trans to other them, to make them seem strange or odd, to call them out for that. So, you know, it definitely has a strong history that is not good. So, you know, while I understand some people aren't comfortable with that, you know, since at least like the 80s or 90s, groups have been reclaiming that. You'll see that language show up when it comes to LGBTQ services very freely. So I wanted to be very careful when I chose this to make sure I did my research on this because, as I said, there are a lot of people who are uncomfortable with it. But at the end of the day, this is something that is changing outside of LAist, and I felt that very strongly where the community is going, that that is going to be the preferred language in the future.
Can you tell us about some of the stories that you have coming up? One in particular that really caught my ear was something you mentioned about vignettes in Queer Joy. That sounds really cool.
This actually comes from, I should mention, a call out that we have for Queer Joy stories. And that still is open. So if you're listening to this and you want to send in your personal story of Queer Joy to be featured, I would love, absolutely love to read it. Pretty much since early May, people have been sending in their stories of what brings them joy in the community. And for some, it's, you know, going to a soccer club. Some it's, you know, just getting to meet their partner for the first time and like realizing how happy they were. There'll be four stories of queer joy that I'll be highlighting. And these are really going to be very personally driven by them. And I'm just excited to tell them. I think we have one coming up who does trainings for, you know, transgender empathy. I also have someone who went to their first lesbian bar for the first time and got to see what a sapphic love could look like in a welcoming space. So I think this is just an exciting space that I'm excited to be in. And, you know, I think the stories will be great to see.
You can find all of that at LAist.com/QueerLA. Caitlin Hernandez is our LA Explained reporter and lead reporter on the Queer LA project. Caitlin, thanks so much for all of your work and for taking the time to talk.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome back to the LA Report. I'm Julia Paskin. LAist has launched a new ongoing reporting project focusing on queer stories all told through the lens of joy. It's called Queer LA. I spoke with lead reporter Caitlin Hernandez about the stories they plan to cover, the use of the word queer, and what it feels like to tell these kinds of stories as a queer and non-binary journalist. So, I woke up this morning and started to go to Twitter, which is like a horrible toxic thing that I do working in the news industry like every morning. And I found myself kind of in like a doom scrolling hole, reading some of the discourse about the backlash against pride in schools. There's been a couple of incidents in Glendale and in North Hollywood that you've actually reported on. And I was like, man, I'm feeling really bad. I'm a queer person. And I was having some difficulty processing it. And then I was like, oh, maybe this is why Caitlin is doing their project, Queer LA. Like, this feels like an antidote to what I'm feeling right now. So with that, can you tell everybody else about your reporting project, Queer LA, and specifically the focus of the stories that you were reporting on?
Yes, definitely. You know, I'm glad that you bring that up because I think what you're describing is exactly the goal I have for it. So Queer LA is a new series at LAist that we're doing that is for LGBTQ plus stories. But, you know, as you mentioned, the news cycle is really, really rough right now. If you're in the community, and also if you're just watching, you know, from abroad, it can be tough to see these attacks on our rights. So I wanted to create a space where our stories could be uplifted and positive and focus on joy. So that's the focus of Queer LA. I want to center the people behind this community and explore how we live more fully and tell our stories. And like I said, focus on joy to really bring that more fully into the zeitgeist of what's going on in this conversation. Because, you know, amid all of this hard news that we're having, we're people.
Can you say that again for the people in the back, Caitlin?
I wish.
We're people. Yeah. We're people. Yeah. It's I think this is something, right? Like this happens with any group of people that is marginalized, right? Like when we pay attention to the very important news, we do. It's like the joy and our identities can sometimes just get like lost in this sea of grief, especially with everything happening not only locally but across the country. What has it been like for you to focus on these kinds of stories, like to think about queer culture in LA through this lens of joy?
You know, I think it has been for me personally a very how do I put this? It's been a very encouraging time. Like I myself am experiencing joy getting to do this project. It's also made me feel more connected to my community because I get to learn more about how the drag culture and the drag scene here in LA works. I get to learn more about what people are doing to make inclusive events, to, you know, build and foster community across, you know, different identities in the community and different age ranges. So I think for me, it's just been a really beautiful outlet to explore how we live more fully.
That's lovely. And can you talk about the use of the word queer? Like, it's a word that I'm personally very comfortable with, but not everybody is. Talk about why you went with that term.
Yes. You know, and I should note, too, I use the word myself, too, to describe, you know, my own identity. I'm queer and non-binary. But, you know, when we did launch the project, we did hear from some folks who weren't comfortable with us using the term. And I hear that and I respect that. I think this is a situation where people being comfortable with the term or uncomfortable, both of those viewpoints are very valid. And that stems from queer's history as a slur. For that term, because, you know, back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, it was used pejoratively against primarily effeminate gay men and people who would be in drag or who were trans to other them, to make them seem strange or odd, to call them out for that. So, you know, it definitely has a strong history that is not good. So, you know, while I understand some people aren't comfortable with that, you know, since at least like the 80s or 90s, groups have been reclaiming that. You have Queer Nation that came out of ACT UP in the 90s who started putting that as their name. Today, you have many of the event runners here in LA use that term. You also have LGBTQ in the acronym. You'll see that language show up when it comes to LGBTQ services very freely. So I wanted to be very careful when I chose this to make sure I did my research on this because, as I said, there are a lot of people who are uncomfortable with it. But at the end of the day, this is something that is changing outside of LAist. And I felt that very strongly where the community is going, that that is going to be the preferred language in the future. It's a useful word in a sense because it can speak to both the fluidity in sexuality and gender.
Yeah, I think that's why I like it for myself, because it feels kind of all encompassing. But, you know, I was called other words growing up. I wasn't called queer. So maybe it's somewhat of a generational thing, like that. Like it doesn't push the trauma button for me the same way that other words might. So I guess, yeah, I'm with you in hearing that that might not feel good for other people. You are reporting on a lot of different expressions of the queer community in LA. Can you tell us about some of the stories that you have coming up? One in particular that really caught my ear was something you mentioned about vignettes in Queer Joy. That sounds really cool.
This actually comes from, I should mention, a call out that we have for Queer Joy stories. And that still is open. So if you're listening to this and you want to send in your personal story of Queer Joy to be featured, I would love, absolutely love to read it. Pretty much since early May, people have been sending in their stories of what brings them joy in the community. And for some, it's, you know, going to a soccer club. Some it's, you know, just getting to meet their partner for the first time and like realizing how happy they were. There'll be four stories of queer joy that I'll be highlighting. And these are really going to be very personally driven by them. And I'm just excited to tell them. I think we have one coming up who does training for, you know, transgender empathy. I also have someone who went to their first lesbian bar for the first time and got to see what a sapphic love could look like in a welcoming space. So I think this is just an exciting space that I'm excited to be in. And, you know, I think the stories will be great to see.
Caitlin, do you want to tell folks your personal story of Queer Joy?
Sure. So my story of Queer Joy probably doesn't start out as a joyful one, but I think it, for me, it just explains how I get here and it's what makes me who I am today. You know, back in 2018, I was closeted. It was before I even knew I was non-binary, but I knew that I was gay. But I also worked at a religious institution that wasn't affirming of that. So I was a little bit under the radar. And, but I knew I wanted to explore the community and get more connected and see, I think, what potentially could be my life if I decided to come out. So I ended up going with a group of friends to Pride in San Francisco. I chose this as my story of queer joy because it was just exciting for me. I had always seen Pride from afar. And to me, in my head, it was kind of like the pinnacle of what acceptance could look like, because you're going to Pride. Everyone there is either, you know, in the community or really strong allies that want to have a good time. And it's super fun. And it was. I got to walk around and see people openly holding hands, you know, giving each other a kiss, whatever. And I got to get a little glimpse of what it could be like to not have to hide myself. And so when I returned, I eventually ended up coming out. I did lose my job, but it led me to a better moment in my life where I'm in now. I am in a very happy queer relationship where I get to hold my partner's hand and, you know, walk down the street, or I, you know, have a group of friends who affirm me for who I am all the time. And there's no doubt about that. So there's a strong sense for me that my story of queer joy has turned into me not having to defend myself anymore.
That makes me feel joyful. And I got to say, Caitlin, I don't know, I've never told you this, but I think part of my willingness to talk about, to even change my pronouns to she, they, has a lot to do with your presence here. It's hard to be the first. It's hard to be the first in an age group. You know, it's a highly personal thing. You know, we put it in our emails and then send it out to all of these people. And I think I felt a lot safer doing that because you are my colleague. So thank you for that.
Oh, I'm going to get a little teary, Julia.
That's true.
Thank you.
It's true. I'm getting a little teary myself. And I got to say also that, like, you know, because we have other colleagues that are non-binary, or, and I see that... they're like way younger than me. And that is, like, young people are really kind of leading the way in, I think, living our lives, not only in our sexuality, but also in our gender expressions. And I'm so grateful for them, too. Like, hooray for the young people.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. But thank you for that, genuinely, because I think making peace with that has made me a happier person.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad.
Yeah. So, Caitlin, this project launched in May. Right now it's Pride Month. How much longer is this reporting project going to continue for?
So I'm glad that you're asking this because, you know, I think when it comes to media, there can be a quick assumption that we're just doing this for Pride or that other outlets are just doing, you know, things about the LGBTQ plus community for Pride. And Queer LA is, you know, obviously started around this time frame. But we are continuing this. This is a long-term project that we're doing. We don't quite necessarily have an end date, purely because, like, our community deserves to be celebrated, and this is something I'm invested in.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait to read more of your reporting. You can find all of that at LAist.com/QueerLA. Caitlin Hernandez is our LA Explained reporter and lead reporter on the Queer LA project. Caitlin, thanks so much for all of your work and for taking the time to talk.
Thank you.
Support comes from Japan House LA presenting Yes, Kawaii is Art. Express yourself. Kawaii translates to cute or adorable, yet its influence extends beyond aesthetics to encompass fashion, art, technology, and even social behavior. Sebastian Masuda, the king of Kawaii, brings together multiple artworks unraveling the kawaii concepts to foster a sense of joy, innocence, and community as a tool for self-expression and representation. Visitors can step into this colorful world to feel the aesthetic for themselves, May 2nd to November 3rd. No admissions fee. More at japanhousela.com.
Having me.
K-pop is one of the biggest musical genres in the world today. Its rise and expansion were 30 years in the making, and many K-pop groups today are household names. But what was it like being a K-pop superstar back in the early days? Today we bring you the story of former K-pop idol Danny Im. Danny was scouted in Los Angeles, then trained and debuted in South Korea as a member of the legendary group One Time. Later, he became a talent scout who helped discover the girl supergroup Blackpink. Now, here's Danny's story in this special bonus episode of LAS Studios' K-Pop Dreaming.
Anytime I'm with my friends Sarah and Randy, and one of us says the phrase one time, we all just bust out singing this one song.
One time is one time for your mind. 원하는 것을 다 너에게 주겠어.
The song is called One Time by the group of the same name, One Time.
One time is one time for your mind. 원하는 것을 다 너에게 주겠어.
One Time is one of the most iconic first-generation K-pop groups from the 90s. They were part of YG Entertainment, and they had this West Coast hip-hop kind of swagger. Their raps were done in both Korean and English, and the group just had this cool factor to them that made them stand out. And One Time's legacy on K-pop today is pretty irrefutable. They inspired the sound of hugely popular second-generation group Big Bang, which then went on to inspire BTS. And for me, One Time lives in my personal K-pop Hall of Fame too, as the first Korean hip-hop group I ever loved. So when I got the chance to talk to one of the members of One Time, my mind was completely blown. From LAist Studios, this is K-pop Dreaming. I'm Vivian Yoon, and in this bonus episode, I will be talking with Danny Im, one of the Korean-American members of One Time.
I always used to say, yo, One Time don't dance, man, right? So we're just jumping around. Right? It was horrendous.
We'll hear some behind-the-scenes stories of how the group came to be, what it was like moving to Korea and becoming a full-blown K-pop star, and about how Danny helped to discover one of the biggest K-pop idols in the world right now. All of that is coming up after the break. We'll be right back.
Danny, even from One Time when he's on stage, totally different person off stage, you know? I'm way more goofy in real life. Try to act all cool when I was on One Time, but that's about it.
I'm on a video call with Danny, and it's pretty surreal seeing his face on my computer screen, like actually reacting live to the things that I am saying. But we have a lot to cover, so I force myself to be professional, and I ask him my first question. How did the group get started?
I mean, just like with many things, I think it was just it was sheer luck. When we first got the opportunity to meet YG, it was me and Teddy. We went to Diamond Bar High School and, you know, we were just friends that liked music.
Teddy is Teddy Park, the other Korean-American member of One Time. He's currently one of the biggest producers in K-pop. But Danny says back in the 90s, they were just two teens growing up in Diamond Bar, which is a city in the San Gabriel Valley. And they both loved music.
We would go to karaoke all the time. They had a special in our area at the karaoke spot that we went to. You only had to pay for an hour and you could stay there from 2 to 6. And we would literally stay there from 2 to 6. If we got tired, we would just sleep in the room, you know, wake up and just, you know, do whatever, eat there, everything. And so that's where I actually even learned how to read Korean. Because before that, I didn't even know how to read Korean. There was just circle, boxes, lines. I had no idea.
It is so true. Korean letters are literally made up of circles, boxes, and lines. Anyway, back to Danny talking about going to karaoke in high school with Teddy.
That's when I started really getting into like Korean music. And Teddy, you know, he taught me a lot because he was actually well-versed in both. You know, he lived basically up until like around 11 years old in Korea. And then he moved out here. We grew closer during those times.
Danny says he and Teddy became good friends. And they ended up meeting a couple music producers through a mutual contact.
We found out that they lived in Diamond Bar. And we're like, oh, really? Where do you live? They live like 2 blocks from Teddy's house. And we've never seen them before in our lives. You know what I mean? It just happened to be they live 2 blocks away from Teddy. So, I mean, we started going there all the time because those were the only people that we knew that had like musical equipment. You know, they had all the stuff to make music, to record music and everything. And we're like, yo, after that day, we would just kick it just to have fun.
Danny says these producer guys, they asked him and Teddy to sing and rap on one of their demos.
So the demo you guys sent to the producers, was that a hip-hop song? Like,
yeah, it was a hip-hop song. It was a straight-up 90s hip-hop song. Man, me and Teddy, we tried for the longest time to track that down. Like, we don't know where it went, what happened to it, or anything like that. But, I mean, I'm talking about, like, there was a little narration in the beginning, like a phone call, like Teddy acting like he just woke up, something like that. Back in the 90s, all of them had that, like, yo, Teddy, what up? Yo, what's up, Danny? Yo, I'm coming to pick you up right now. All right, man. Yo, where we going? We're going studio, man. You know, I got something hot or something. He goes, all right, let's do this. And then the beat drops or something like that. It sounds corny now, but that was the 90s.
Danny says the producer sent the demo to a bunch of other music producers in South Korea. And one of the people who heard the demo was YG, one of the big three in K-pop in the 90s.
And then I guess, you know, YG just asked, like, so who are these kids on the demo? And he just said, let me meet them when I come to the States next time.
YG is serious about meeting Danny and Teddy. So the next time he's in LA, the producer guys call up the two friends and tell them to show up at a hotel in Koreatown in LA.
So we met them in like this hotel room in LA. And the thing is, it was pretty intimidating at first because it's not like a setting where, you know, like you're ready for an audition. He was actually like lounging in the bed like this, you know.
Danny mimes lying on his side, propping his head up with his hand. Very casual. But he says there are other people in the room too. A bunch of legendary Korean music producers and even a K-pop star.
Sean Young from Keep Six, YG's very first group. And Q was there. And it was just these people there. And then there was this couch. And then we sat there and he just talked to us for a little bit. And then basically he just goes, okay, do something. You know what I mean? We're like, what? So he just basically had to sit there and just do something. So I remember like Teddy rapped and sang a little. And then I rapped and sang a little, whatever.
Danny says that right after singing and rapping for YG, that was kind of it. He and Teddy just left the room.
We're exiting the room and me and Teddy looking at each other like, yeah, I do not think anything is going to happen from that. I don't think we did great. I mean, we know who YG was and everything like that, but I didn't think anything was going to happen from that.
Then a couple days later, YG invites Danny and Teddy to dinner. And Danny says they think this is a really nice way for YG to reject them.
Me and Teddy were just like, yeah, that's cool, man. He's, it's like a sorry, but maybe next time dinner. And we're like, yeah, that's nice, right? But at that dinner, he just threw it out there. He goes like, yo, why don't you guys come to Korea? And we're like, yo, what? And so we had to go back and basically talk to our parents and stuff. Because for me, it was during the summer after my junior year. Teddy just graduated, so he was a little bit more open and free. So my parents were a little bit harder to convince, you know? But I mean, straight up truth, I wasn't the best student in the world. So at the end of the day, I think they came to the conclusion of, know, maybe we should let him go. You know, he ain't doing that great here, so maybe we should let him go. And plus, he really wanted to do this, and they knew that.
So with his parents' blessing, Danny flies to Seoul to try and become a K-pop star under YG Entertainment. And when he gets there, he experiences a complete culture shock.
I remember walking on the streets, like in a very busy street for the first time, and I just flipped out because I've never seen so many Koreans in one spot in my life. You know what I mean? I'm like, everywhere I look, everybody's Korean. This is crazy to me, you know, growing up in the States, and it was just so much diversity. I think I saw my first foreigner like 2 weeks later, and I just like, yo, I started like flipping out on him. Yo, what's up, man? So nice to see you. And this dude was just like, who's this crazy kid? But
That's so funny.
At 17, the culture shock was pretty crazy to me.
Danny says there was also a surprising language barrier.
I thought my Korean was good enough, at least for, you know, simple conversations. But anytime someone talked to me, if like Teddy wasn't next to me, they wouldn't know what I'm saying. They just look at Teddy and go, yo, what did this dude say?
But Danny spent most of his time with the other trainees at YG's facilities.
What was YG like back then?
Like, it was a very much smaller operation. Like, it was just a basement. So it was a building, which he owns now, by the way. It was a building he didn't own. He just rented out the bottom basement. And at the basement was basically everything. It was the little dancing studio spot, his office, the manager's office, the common room or whatever. And then the bathroom was actually, you had to go up two floors. And when I first got there, you know, I'm from the States. So the bathroom was basically no toilet, the hole on the ground thing. You know what I mean?
Even now, a lot of older public restrooms won't have like a seated toilet. They'll just have this porcelain hole in the ground. And Danny says that's what the old building had.
So, I mean, that's how old school was. And I remember first time I was like, yo, Teddy, how you use this, man? Right? Like, I mean, that's how different it was now. And then, you know, fast forward like many, many years later, and now with the new building and everything like that, when the new building came up, I'm like, yo, there's fingerprint identification for each floor and stuff. And I'm like, yo, man, just I was there when it was a hole on the ground, man. Like, yo.
So crazy.
Yeah, it was a smaller operation for sure, yeah.
The idea of YG's headquarters being in a basement and having that old school toilet is kind of mind-blowing. Because now, YG owns this giant 9-story building in Seoul that looks like it's straight out of the future, with all this curved glass and metal. And the new building is actually right next door to the old one that Danny's talking about. But Danny says that even though YG was in its early days back then, there were other trainees there, and all of them were learning to sing and dance under YG's direction.
There was a bunch of people there already, 연습생s, that's what we call them.
Oh, yeah.
What do you call them in the States? I'm not even sure, actually. Trainees. There you go.
But Danny and Teddy were the only Korean-American trainees. And they ended up sharing a lot of American music and culture with the other guys.
Like me and Teddy, when we went, I remember the other trainees and everything like that. We're basically introducing them to different types of music that they wouldn't know. Because it's not just blasting on TV. It's not just something that just comes up on the radio or anything like that in Korea in those days. Like, if we told them about, like, Wu-Tang, they didn't know who that was.
So Danny spends a ton of time with his fellow trainees. They practice dancing, singing, rapping, trying to get ready to debut. But when it's time to assemble the actual group, not everyone makes the cut.
So there was Baekhyun and Jinhwan.
Baekhyun and Jinhwan are the other two members of Wontime.
And like six other people. And then it got cut down. And then it then ended up being the four of us. And that was like, I think I was there training for about a little over a year, which is very short.
That's so short compared to now.
Because at that time, YG was a small operation and basically, there was only Jinushun, you know what I mean?
Jinushun was a really popular hip-hop group, but they were the only artists from YG on the scene at the time.
And, like, they needed another artist to come out, so they just threw us out there. So it was extremely short compared to what it is now.
Okay, for comparison, the average training period for a trainee these days is somewhere between 2 and 4 years. And some people have even stayed in the system for 10 years before debuting. So Danny and Teddy training for 1 year, that was pretty short.
And then, you know, one time when you guys all got put together, How did it become that you became like the vocalist of the group?
No one else wanted to sing. Straight up, no one wanted to sing. Baek Young did a little bit in the beginning, and then he goes, "Nah, I'm good." And so later on, I'm the only person singing. You know, so I guess they call that the main vocal. I don't know.
How did you even get the name One Time? Did YG just come up with it for
actually,
you?
Actually, Perry came up with it. So Perry is one of the first producers at YG. I mean, this guy did everything. He was a good rapper, good dancer, good producer. He even danced really good.
Danny is talking about Perry Thomas Borja, an influential producer and artist who was at YG back then. Danny says at first, Perry threw out a couple different names.
And then later on, One Time came out. One Time for Your Mom, One Time. We're like, you know what? That's cool. We like that.
So they get the name One Time, which is an acronym for One Time for Your Mind. And they released their first album in 1998, which includes the song My Friends and I Love, One Time. One time is one time
for your mind. It is like subliminal messaging. I think we said like one time like 10 times in that first verse to the hook.
Danny says they performed the song for the first time on a show on Mnet, a Korean music TV channel. And the performance isn't great because none of them are that great at dancing.
I always just say, yo, one time don't dance, man, right? So we're just jumping around, right? It was horrendous. So YG was like, yo, we can't do that. We got to change that up.
Danny says that performance was so bad, YG decided to put backup dancers in future shows and have the guys dance less. But Danny wasn't sure how many more shows they would even get to do. That's how bad it was.
After our first performance, we thought, yo, we're not going to make it. Me and Baek Young, I still remember this. We're in the kitchen basically talking like, yo, so what are you going to do now? I don't know. I guess I got to go back to the States and go to school. You know, this after our first performance, we're going to have our next performance. But we just thought, oh, you know what? It might not work out, you know? So we're trying to think of future plans, right?
So obviously the group wasn't a flop. The song One Time blew up, and their album became one of the best-selling albums of the year. And the group went on to win these big Korean music awards, officially putting them on the map. But Danny says when they went on tour for their first album, it was really tough.
Back in those days, it was like they grinded you. Like you had to do every single show. I mean, you did everything. It was craziness, like for like 8 months, and you're doing like every show possible. And there was a lot more back then. I remember one of the shows, who was that one comedian that he had glasses?
Yoo Jae-suk.
There you go.
This person, Yoo Jae-suk, he's arguably the most famous comedian turned MC in South Korea. And he's hosted a ton of legendary shows over the years.
But I remember us during our first album and Yoo Jae-suk, when he was just starting out, we were doing this like weird show in like the mountains away from civilization in this small community. And he's in this like grasshopper costume.
So when this comedian Yoo Jae-suk was first starting out, he would wear this bright green grasshopper costume as part of his act. And Danny is saying that Yoo Jae-suk was wearing the costume during the show with One Time at this random little venue in the mountains.
So during a little break, like he's in his costume, we're all smoking together and we're kind of all looking at each other like, what are we doing? Right? Like, do we really have to do this? You know what I mean? Like, I remember him too is just like, aigo, 힘들다, right?
Okay, I'm like dying at this point. Because the idea of this super famous comedian wearing a grasshopper costume, smoking outside of a show and saying, oh man, this is hard, huh? Like basically wondering how they all got there is so funny. But yeah, Danny says the group, they really paid their dues.
Our first album, it was just, I mean, there was no time to think. You did all these bunch of shows, you went to sleep for a couple hours, you woke up, you did all these other things. So it was just kind of like just craziness. In those days when you do a show in the countryside, because you know they don't get to see you often, they go a little nuts. Like I remember we were stuck in the car and like the fans just surrounded it and they're just like climbing on top of it and it's like shaking and there's like no security and we're just like, we're gonna die, right? That's when I kind of was like, yo, this is crazy.
One Time stays popular for a long time. They put out 5 records, and Danny even records a solo album between the 4th and 5th One Time albums. But eventually, the grind slowed down, because in 2006, after their 5th album, One Time went on hiatus. One of the group's members had to fulfill his mandatory military service. And then, they never really got back together. Afterward, Danny started working with YG Entertainment, and he ended up helping to scout one of the biggest K-pop stars in the world today. That's coming up after the break.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
So after 8 years of performing and making music together as a group, One Time goes on hiatus. And Danny suddenly finds himself having to figure out what's next. And as he's hanging out in the YG offices trying to figure it out, he has this realization.
I remember it was just one day, I just thought, all around the office, there's all these trainees and stuff like that. And as more time passed, it just one day it came into my mind like, okay, so I see what these kids are going through. And of course, they were going through all these training programs. They had, a dance instructor, singing instructor, even language people. And it was just all these things. But as I was thinking about it, I was thinking, they don't have anybody around them that actually did this, that actually had to go through being an artist and what it's like. So I just thought, hey, I have this information that I don't know who else to give it to. Maybe some of my wisdom that I could pass along the things that I've been through. And I don't know how much it's going to help, but I would love to just, be around the kids and maybe talk with them and just, if in a way I can, just get them mentally prepared of what they're going to basically go through. They're getting prepared for everything else except for the mental aspect of what it's actually going to be like. So I just thought if maybe I can help them with that, it'll just be pretty fulfilling just to pass on this knowledge that I don't think will be the same to others, except for the people in their situation. So that's what I kind of put myself into.
Danny started working with the trainees at YG, including the massively popular second generation group, Big Bang.
I'll tell you how Big Bang came up with their name. So
yeah,
their name, no one could think about it either. Everything sounded corny, this or that. So it was around the time Busta Rhymes, like he had an album out that just came out, right? And it was like sitting on the desk. And that album was The Big Bang. And YG just looked at it and said, Big Bang. And that was it.
No way.
That's why they're called Big Bang.
Danny also got involved in the scouting process. And he helped discover some of the most well-known K-pop idols right now.
Have you auditioned like people that became super famous later?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Lisa from Blackpink. So we had an open audition in Thailand, and we went there, and I think we only saw like 30 something people, and she just stood out. She was extremely young at the time. She was like 14 or something like that. But I just remember me and Daehyung were talking, and she's like, she did stand out. She had this confidence that even I was like, is that too much confidence? But when we talked to her, she was very humble, So, I mean, she had this thing that it was like we couldn't forget,
Danny also saw the audition tape for another member of Blackpink.
And I was around for Jennie's first audition. I remember seeing her audition tape for the first time.
Oh, wow. What'd you think?
And it was, there was something about her. So her audition tape wasn't flawless. I think she messed up the lyrics in between or something. And the thing I didn't get was she didn't record another tape. She sent that one. You know what I mean? Like you have as many takes as you want, right? And she didn't. She just laughed at herself and she kept going. And it was just, what's up with that, right? Like never saw that before. And so you remember that.
And Teddy Park, Danny's friend from high school who was also in One Time, he is now Blackpink's producer. And he's produced all of the group's hit songs like this one, called Doo-doo-doo-doo, from 2018. Before Blackpink, Teddy also produced music for a bunch of iconic second-generation K-pop artists too, like Seven, Big Bang, and 21.
Teddy influenced a lot, I think. You know, Teddy's contribution is humongous. His first song that he ever produced was during our second album, the year 2000. And this guy's still one of the top producers. It's like, yo, what's up with that? He listens to what's going on in the world, and he adapts to that.
It's clear that Danny has a lot of admiration for Teddy and his contribution to the genre of K-pop. But when I asked Danny about his own legacy...
Don't like speaking on my own contributions, because you don't speak on your own history of what right. you've done for the world, right? Yeah. The world is supposed to say that, not you.
Since Danny won't do it, I will. Danny Im was extremely influential in the K-pop scene. Not only was he part of this legendary hip-hop group, One Time, but he also went on to help other stars through the trainee process at YG too, like Bobby from Icon. And he helped discover superstars like Lisa and Jennie from Blackpink. Danny also had his own TV show for a while, on a channel called Mnet America, a talk show called Danny from LA.
Today on Danny from LA, we show you what's happening in the world of K-pop. Check out our exclusive interview.
And Danny's had a lasting impact on K-pop.
나는 진짜 어렸을 때 형들 보면서 뭐라 해야 되지? 진짜 swag.
This is Taeyang, one of the members of Big Bang, telling Danny how he pretty much learned his swag from watching One Time. I asked Danny if he ever listens to the song that my friends and I love, One Time.
I don't even know the lyric. I mean, I got kids. I don't get to control what we listen to and don't have much control on anything these days.
Danny says that now he has different responsibilities. He's a dad to two kids. But even though his life looks very different from his K-pop days, to me, he'll always be Danny Im from One Time.
Thank you so much. That was super fun. All your stories are so good.
You get me talking, I just keep talking, dude. That's about it.
Thanks for listening to the weekend edition of the LA Report. The Weekend LA Report is hosted by me, Julia Paskin, and produced by Michael Cosentino with assistance from producer Daniel Martinez. Our engineer is Sean Corey Campbell. Our podcast is edited by Megan Garvey. Catherine Mailhouse is the director of content development, and our vice president of podcasts is Shayna Naomi Crockmall. Join us back here tomorrow. You can read more at LAist.com and listen live on the LAist app or on the radio at 89.3 FM. Listeners like you help make the LA Report possible. Please donate at laist.com/join. This podcast is supported by Gordon and Donna Crawford, who believe quality journalism makes Southern California a better place to live. I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.